Score, the podcast. The only show taking you inside the studios of the world's most celebrated composers and musical storytellers. Presented by Spitfire Audio.
I am Kenny Holmes. What is your name, sir?
My name is Robert Kraft.
The Kraft. This is Score, the podcast presented by Spitfire Audio. I'm having so much fun this season. I just feel like there's a good vibe in the air. Things are getting back to normal, but we still are in these little boxes. But it's okay because we're on YouTube now, so you can watch us. We're really excited about our guest today. Before I get to that, though, say hello to composer Carol. Good morning, Carol.
Good morning.
Composer Carol, would you like to play us some Debussy or Smile While Your Heart is Breaking? Carol's got such a beautiful record out. We're all here, and I agree, Kenny, that this is, for some reason, season four has been just joyful so far. I mean, I don't want to jinx anything, but it's just been fun and relaxed and great guests. And
yeah,
so
and we have a lot of great guests coming up. I wish I could tell you, but a lot of exciting stuff to come, as well as today's guest. He's an Oscar-nominated composer, David Newman. He's part of the legacy family, the what would you call the
dynasty.
The dynasty of film music. Alfred Newman, his father, his brother Thomas, his cousin Randy. I mean, this is, he was born with a baton in his hand, I think, maybe. I don't know.
I think you're right.
But the list of movies, I mean, some of the my favorite comedies, The Sandlot, Nutty Professor, Matilda, Anastasia, which he was Oscar nominated for, How to Lose a Guy in 10 Days, Cat in the Hat, Bill and Ted's, I mean, Galaxy Quest. He's the maestro behind a lot of these classic
we did
comedies.
Ice Age,
Mighty Ducks. Yep. And he's also a renowned conductor. He does a lot of the shows at the Hollywood Bowl, the maestro at the movie show with John Williams. Yep. He's up on the stage doing that. If you haven't seen those shows, by the way, they're back on the schedule. Things are coming back. Danny Elfman has a Nightmare Before Christmas show here in LA that's on the books. Ludwig Göransson's Black Panther is going to be playing at the Hollywood Bowl this year, this summer. And everything's going back to full capacity. So it's an exciting time. Hans Zimmer Live Experience, it has a European tour scheduled in 2022, and all those dates are out. So it just feels, you can feel it. You can feel it in the air. You can feel it. That things are coming back, and hopefully more of these concerts around the country and around the world for many of our listeners to go check out too. But plan a trip to see that John Williams concert every year. You never know when it's going to be the last one, and you just got to go see it. And they're doing another one this year with David Newman, our guest. So we'll be able to talk to him about conducting those shows at the Bowl. And also, there may be a tie-in to he's doing the West Side Story remake with Steven Spielberg. And I think there might be a connection of how he came on board with that film in regard to the Hollywood Bowl. Didn't he conduct a performance of that you saw?
I was there. It was incredible. First of all, the movie's incredible. But to hear a live orchestra play that score, which many of us know every note, every word. I mean, so many people grew up with the West Side Story score, and to hear "When you're a jet, all the way from your first cigarette to your last dying day." And it's just, and to sit in the Hollywood Bowl, which is, I read this weekend, it's considered America's premier outdoor venue. There's Tanglewood and there's Red Rocks and there's some great ones, but the Hollywood Bowl is historic. It's been there since, I think, 1924. It's had the Beatles there and it's had presidents speak there. And so an evening at the Hollywood Bowl, I mean, we might want to make them a sponsor after this little bit.
Right.
But
I was going to say, I can't wait to see what they do with Black Panther.
Oh,
because with the 808s, and I mean, are they going to have the big drums? Is there going to be digital stuff playing there? But Carol, I know you're excited about that one.
Mm-hmm. Damn. I wonder if Ludwig will be be on stage or just in the audience. I don't know if he would hire a conductor. Something to look forward to. I think
he'd be performing.
You think so?
Yeah. Playing guitar? Not, right? I don't know. Maybe.
Or he'll be playing that.
I think that'd be cool.
What's the
I think he played on The Mandalorian.
But no, there's a little, there's a whistle in Black Panther, isn't there?
I'm
mixing them up in my head now. But anyway, regardless, there's so many shows on the books and just live events, and music is back, and it's just a good feeling. Before we get to our interview with David Newman, of course, we want to take a minute to thank our sponsor, Spitfire Audio, maker of orchestral sample libraries for film composers. Whether you're just starting out or a seasoned professional, Spitfire has so many sounds you'll love.
Yes, they will. And one of the things that I love about Spitfire is that every month they release a new library. I actually download, you know, the free labs, they're called. Mm-hmm. It's a whole series of really cool instruments. You can even get an entire orchestra for free in the form of their BBC Symphony Orchestra Discover Edition.
Some of those labs packages, they would be worth buying. The fact that they make them free is incredible.
So high quality.
Yeah, there's so many different sounds. I mean, if you go on their website, there's got to be like close to 100 different libraries and different packages. And here's where the good news comes in for you. We have a promo code for you that you can use to save on your first Spitfire order. Our listeners save 25% off your first purchase using the promo code SCORE2021, and that's good on all their packages, including the one that we're going to play a little cue from for you at the end of the show today, Abbey Road 1 Orchestral Foundations. That package is a 90-piece orchestra recorded in the same place as Star Wars, Indiana Jones, Harry Potter, Lord of the Rings, Avengers Endgame, and so many more. The Big Room at Abbey Road Studios. All those great instruments, and you can use them at your fingertips on your home computers there.
How I just want to make sure I got this right. Did you say 25% off if you use the promo code SCORE2021?
No way.
I know. Such a deal. Ridiculous. But it's not going to last forever. These podcasts will be published, and you'll be able to hear them forever, but the promo codes will not. So make sure to get on there, get your SCORE2021 promo code, put it in the cart. That lets them know we sent you, and it saves you 25%. It's exclusive to you, our listeners. And then again, listen for that demo cue at the end of the show today so you can hear some of the different sounds to elevate your music. I think we should just get to it. We have so much to talk with David Newman about, and let's get right to it. We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, Oscar-nominated composer David Newman joins Score the Podcast. Stick around. We'll be right back.
Hey, guys. It's good to see you. I wanted to tell you about this thing called More Score. Have you heard about this?
I have heard about it, but that's because I read everything. So, I mean, there's very little I've
heard. It gets printed daily
and I'm on it.
Delivered to your front doorstep. Yes. More Score is what it is.
It's our new Patreon show. And all of our listeners can go check it out. We're putting out episodes all the time. And you're probably wondering, what's Patreon? Have you heard of Patreon?
Could you
before?
Tell me?
Rob, I'd be delighted to tell you. Patreon is a website where our fans basically can crowdfund and tell us the type of content that they would like us to be able to go produce. So we've been going out and doing interviews with people. Obviously, we've interviewed you both directly there, and a little bit about your lives and the people who you've crossed paths with, but also Carlos Rafael Rivera of The Queen's Gambit on Netflix, and the guys from Cobra Kai, which it was kind of cool. We found out that when we recorded with Chris Beck for Score a Film Music Documentary, those guys were just getting coffee. They might have offered us coffee.
I think Zach said they did, I think. And it was great coffee, which was a great sign for their futures.
Yes.
I remember that. And he actually told me that his career has been completely downhill since that moment. But
that wasn't in the interview, so it doesn't count. If he said anything of the sort, then it wasn't on the record.
Okay, Zach, sorry, man.
But we're putting these episodes out all the time. More Score. How do you get to it? You can go to patreon.com/morescore. Or download the Patreon app and search More Score. Oh, of course, here's my alarm going off right as we're recording this.
That's because it's so exciting. It's you've like set the alarm off.
This is like these little reads that we're doing right now for More Score are we're going to do a couple of them, and our listeners can collect them all if they aren't hitting that little 15.
You should
skip
make an
button,
NFT
which,
out of them. Yeah,
I was going to say you can make a non fungible token out of a More Score read.
Yeah, we could do that. We do have an official season four Score the Podcast NFT that's now available. We have one for each season, not for each episode, but for each season. So if anyone out there, we're getting off track. More Score is on Patreon. It's you can go to it, patreon.com/morescore. We're putting out episodes all the time, and it's extra stuff. It's stuff you won't hear on Score the Podcast. Access to different people, interesting voices. And for your support, we have these perks too. So you can get a pretty cool little collector's t-shirt that we're putting out now. This coffee mug that's pretty cool, has all the kind of our instrument, orchestra instrument look on it. It's pretty cool stuff. So, you can support us there. Patreon.com/.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
More Score.
Hi, this is Howard Shore. You're listening to Score the Podcast. Now let's go back to the program.
Welcome back to Score the Podcast, presented by Spitfire Audio. We're super excited about our guest today. I know we've been trying to get David on the show for the last couple of seasons, and some scheduling things didn't work out, so now, better than ever, though, he has a huge movie coming out at the end of the year, West Side Story, much anticipated. He's also the composer of so many of our favorite films over the years. One of my personal favorites, Sandlot, that music just tells you it's summertime, it's time to go to the ballpark. I could go on forever on your list of films, but David Newman, thank you so much for joining the show today.
Our live studio audience.
Thanks for having me. Sandlot, I remember that. I don't think that was you, Robert. I think that was after you left, because that was like an insane. I remember we recorded it mostly in Utah, which was a right to work. But then they added about 30 minutes of music, which we then ended up doing. So it ended up being a union movie anyway. It was a wacky thing. There was about a 30-minute ending where they go looking for the ball, all this like action stuff. So we ended up doing that. That's when Elliot was there, I think, after you. Or was Elliot
before
after
me?
You
Sandlot
you?
Preceded
yeah,
me.
Before you.
Sandlot, right. I think, because it was on the wall of an executive's office when I first arrived. And I thought, okay, I know this movie. And is that a Fox movie? I knew so little. But oddly, It's a funny even a topic to bring up. What little I knew about my job at Fox was that I was inheriting a chair, literally, that your father created. And the reverence on the lot for the position I was in, which was both your father and your uncle's chair prior to me, and
Robert, really quick, can you explain so our listeners know what you mean by the chair?
So I very surprisingly to everyone, most of all me, ended up becoming the head of music at 20th Century Fox, which is a position that was made legendary by the first head of music at 20th Century Fox, Alfred Newman, who happens to be the father of our guest today. Alfred Newman then handed the job was inherited somewhere in there by David's uncle, Lionel Newman. And between the two of them, they span something like 50 years.
1939 to whenever Lionel left. I'm not sure.
I think
when exactly he
I'd left. Like to say eight,
it was
84 or 5.
Yeah.
So did you go to work with Dad a lot back then, David, when you were a kid?
I was born in 54. My father was born in 1900. He died in 1970. So kind of I was a little bit too little. Like my cousin Randy Newman, obviously the artist and songwriter, Randy spent a lot of time at Fox in the 50s, in the late 50s, when it was still a studio system with a contract orchestra, meaning they had a full-time orchestra, all these studios. It wasn't freelance. They were there all the time. They had a certain number of hours they were paid a week. If they went over, they were paid overtime. If they didn't work at all, they might not work in the summer. They were still paid. It was like it was a full-time job. And that all changed in about 1959 when my father left. And then, Robert, I think there was a few years where it was turning into more television stuff, which Lionel was doing more of the early TV stuff. And then eventually Lionel took it over. And as you said, really ran the department, as you did, too. And the thing that Robert did was he saved the scoring stage, if I may be so bold as to say. I mean, that was an incredible thing. That happened, that scoring stage wasn't dumped. I'm sure you probably talked about this
never,
on the podcast. But
it's never come up. Oh, one of the classic locations for film scoring, and I thank you for that. I just remember being told shortly after I arrived that very casually someone said, by the way, we're turning the Fox scoring stage, which was stage one, the legendary location of the first sound recording on movies, even though Warner's came out with Al Jolson's picture,
the jazz singer. In 27.
Correct.
Yeah.
But Fox had recorded already sound to picture on that stage. I was told very casually, we're going to be thinking about turning this into office space. We need more office space on the lot. And I said, wait a minute, that's crazy.
Well, it was a miracle. Also, Robert, it had been adjusted for television. They made what they call isolation booths because television was sort of a different way of recording, and they needed a booth so that the drummer could be in a booth rather than in the room with the orchestra, et cetera, et cetera. So, but Robert, part of the plan was putting it back historically to the way it was, which I'm sure was part of the allure of convincing them to actually do this, because not only did they not dump it, they spent a bunch of money restoring it to the way it was in the 30s, 40s, and the heydays in the 50s when it was one of the premier scoring stages in Los Angeles.
It's one of those things that now never happens anymore, which is something actually went right. They spent the requisite amount of dough to restore it. I don't know why we got so lucky that they kind of said, oh, okay, let's do this. I mean, there were larger agendas. We should maybe it was the timing.
It was great. Yeah, it was great, Robert, too, because the control room used to be on a second floor and it was small. But you guys kept the control room that you had because it was so nice and big and you could fit so many people in it. So the only thing that's different is the control room, and it's a modern, beautiful, it's the best control room of any of these big, well, the ones that are left. I mean, it's Warner Brothers, Fox, and Sony are the only ones left. There used to be a wonderful scoring stage at Goldwyn where a lot of classic films were scored, and Todd A.O. at CBS, and they're all closed now. But Fox is still going,
still pumping. So, Fox,
kudos for that.
Well, listen,
Robert,
it's so wonderful how this also continues into now. It's called, if I'm not mistaken, and I'm not, the Newman Scoring Stage. I mean, I would say that as my car left the lot the last time after my 18 years, somebody said, okay, he's gone, let's give it a new name, the Newman Scoring Stage. I mean, it was like 2 weeks later they decided to name it. And David, I don't know if you've had a couple experiences on that stage, many, many, many experiences, but one of the ones that is most memorable for me is you stepped on to that podium and re-recorded
the
logo written by your father. I've always wondered, and this is an opportunity to ask, did you find original charts? Did you do a takedown of?
No, they had that logo was written in 35, I think, when Alfred Newman was still through the 30s. He was at UA a lot. He was working mostly for Goldwyn, who was kind of freelancing at UA, United Artists. But Zanuck loved my dad because Zanuck loved Daryl Zanuck.
Head of loved Fox streets, Studios.
He loved streets. Like Alfred Newman arrived in Los Angeles in 1930, the beginning of 1930, right when talking films had started. Max Steiner came maybe a month earlier. They had both been Broadway conductors and arrangers. And all of a sudden, there's like talking films and where are they going to go find people to do music? Because now they got to do music, right? So they go to Broadway, which is the place to go. And so one of the first film, and they were trying to figure out, like, how do you score a film, right? Do you have music all the way through? Do you have no music? And the directors and editors and everyone kept saying, well, if there's music, where does the music come from? So they had this argument all through the 30s, where finally they sort of figured it out. But in 1931, my dad did a movie called Street Scene. And it had an overture that was very modern, very American, very New York. The movie takes place on a block in New York in the summer, and it's a murder. It's a noir, sweaty New York kind of theater thing. And he wrote this theme, and then there was a big like montage in the middle of the movie where these characters kind of run around, and he uses the theme again. And they uses the theme at the end. And Daryl Zanuck just flipped out over this theme. So he was constantly trying to get Alfred Newman over. Daryl Zanuck, I think, started at Fox in the mid-30s and kept trying to get Alfred Newman. And finally, so Alfred Newman did write the logo without the extension, right. Robert. Remember the
Cinerama extension in 56.
Yeah. So the original one was that's the original logo. But in 1954, after it would say Fox, it would say CinemaScope, and then the music would go da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. And everyone remembers this from Star Wars because it was no one was using it in the 60s because of the way movies were scored in the 60s. But when John Williams used it at the beginning of Star Wars, almost as an underscore cue, because it was all about going back to the, you know, Star Wars, you can make a case that it's a Flash Gordon, you know, adventure 30s swashbuckler movie in space, you know. And so John used the logo, which is in the key of B flat, you know.
This is good to know for Jeopardy.
Yeah, and then the first chord in the Star Wars theme, so it would be da 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 da, and then there's the scroll on a long time in a galaxy not far away, and then the first chord for Star Wars is a big B flat dum da da dum da 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 da, like a fanfare.
So that's amazing.
And since then, the fanfare I think has really come into the sort of popular vernacular in a different way than it was when it was originally done.
Well,
but yeah, we recorded that was the first thing that was recorded, Robert, on the new stage was that, and there was all was the logo, and there was press there, and you made a whole thing out of it. It was like a whole. It was on the news that night, and
did we need to record it for stereo or for anything or just for press?
It was press.
I was going to say it sounds.
It was
made for press. That moment.
And here's David
Robert
Newman.
You guys,
Kurt, do it.
No, you. I'm assuming your PR department or you guys staged the event and you know, and yeah, I mean, there's been millions of recordings of the logo. That music is, you know, Fox had a wonderful music preparation department, bar none. That went to the present day, the Joanne Kaye Music Service, which is the how it just sort of evolved, that's all Fox Music preparation. And they were very good about keeping scores and parts where, you know, the famous story of MGM, who were the exact opposite. All the MGM, Busby Berkeley musicals and Wizard of Oz and Gone, all that stuff just went into a garbage dump.
Oh, no.
At the 405, right where the 405 and Sunset Boulevard, they there was a dump there. They just threw it all away. Guess why, Robert? They needed office space. So because this is all physical storage of you know, hundreds of movies a year for years and years. I mean, it is a logistical issue. So MGM threw it all away. Fox, of course, kept all. Like Disney was really good at that because they knew about re-releasing their movies and stuff. But most of the studios just, they didn't give a crap. It was all one-offs, and they just threw it away. So that's sort of the story.
I think there are two salient features. I could sit here and listen to features. David yeah. all day.
Oh, isn't it great? And it's also, so interesting. I think, David, as long as we're digging deep, two things just need to be included in this incredible history. One, Johnny Williams and the B-flat relationship between the end of Alfred's logo and the beginning of Star Wars has also a Fox Newman Williams combo, because I inherited the story that the office that I sat in, all due deference to Carol Farhat, who had been in the department for many years, said, you know, in your office, not only did Alfred sit here and then Lionel, but there was a piano, and Johnny Williams, the studio piano player in that orchestra, used to come at lunch and play the piano and work and hang out in this office with Lionel, because they were best friends. They're great friends.
Well, yeah, I mean, best friends, like friends for the ages. They were as close as you can be. And John's office was at the other corner, Robert. So like your office was, I don't know the north, south, east, west part, but on the other end of the hallway was John's office. So when Lionel was there, that's where John worked. It didn't matter if it was a Fox film. You know, a lot of the Spielberg films were done there. You know, Lionel conducted a bunch, you know, all that stuff. And when Lionel left, you know, then John now goes to Amblin and has an office at Amblin. But John always liked being there in the center of the thing. And the other thing that we used to do, Tom, my brother Tom and I, and some of our friends have, like, my dad was a really late riser. He kept New York theater hours. But Lionel and John, like, got up at, like, 5 in the morning. They were kind of morning people, and they worked in the morning, and they stopped at 6 o'clock, and they didn't work in the, you know what I mean? It was like sort of a different thing. But Lionel would always hold court, like, somewhere between, like, 6:30 a.m. to about 8, and you're in that office. There would be a big pile of donuts and coffee, and all the people that, the composers that were working on the lot that wanted to hang, where in my dad's day, they'd stop at 6 o'clock, go to a bungalow and drink and get drunk and do drugs to stay up all
and
night.
And then record sometimes at night.
Yeah, and then record all night, right. In this era, the hanging was done in the morning. So Tom and I got to, like, go and, you know, we'd just be sort of like a fly on the wall and listen to that, you know. I saw a lot more of Lionel than my father, because Lionel lived a lot. You know, I was just a little shy of 16 when my father died. But Lionel was around a lot. So I did see a lot of that.
But you're not.
And John,
you don't speak as profanely as your uncle Lionel. You're far more polite and respectful. Lionel is legendary. The stories, they're about at least a dozen jokes I've been told of. Well, did you ever hear the story about Lionel Newman when he was told not to say anything dirty to an orchestra, and he got up on the podium and said, I've been told this, and then would say some classic thing.
Yeah. And when he won it, his one Academy Award was for Hello, Dolly, the movie that almost bankrupted Fox. I don't think he swore, but he did something that you would just never. He said, "I'm, you know, damn or some kind of very thing close to a, you know, you were scared he was going to say something on TV that was profane. So, yeah.
David, yeah, so many great stories, but I do want to ask you about you and your interest and when that started, because you said you didn't go hang out at the office with Dad and he passed when you were a teenager. Were you already interested in this world, kind of just hanging around with Lionel and watching this kind of stuff? Or when did you get the spark? Because like it's very much in your family, and I'm sure there was a lot of like pressure to get into music in some fashion, right?
There was no pressure to get into film music. There was even Tom had wanted to, Thomas, I just call him Tom, but he always wanted to be a composer. I was interested in conducting and the violin. We both went to university or conservatory-ish university. I studied violin performance and conducting. Tom did composition. But none of us were thinking of a film music track. Mm. Randy maybe a little more than us, but Randy was already famous before he ever started doing film music.
Because his pal Lenny Warnicker, and he conspired to get Randy as a recording artist at Warner Brothers, and Randy deserved it, of course. And
yeah.
And so he had a huge career as an artist.
Yeah. It's, you know, he still does. Mm-hmm. But I think Randy's love, like all of us, it's like a siren song. It's so weird. None of us felt any pressure. My mom, we certainly had pressure to be trained as musicians, but it really took with the three of us, me, Tom, and my younger sister, Maria. So it really wasn't like, you know, we were all studying violin when we were 7 years old, and then piano, and then theory and counterpoint really early on. And then we went, you know, we all did the university track. We all did graduate work and all that. But the film part of it just happened to each one in a sort of different way. For me, I was working in the 70s as a fiddle player, but I wanted to be a conductor, but it, you know, it wasn't really going anywhere. You know, I couldn't see it as anything that was going to happen. So I just decided to try film.
How did you decide? I mean, I didn't know this, that first of all, were you a studio violinist kind of on call
on some John Williams scores, right?
I played on a lot. I played on E.T. I played on 1941. I played on Monsignor, which was another John Williams score of that era. Played on a bunch of Jerry Goldsmith thing. The first thing I ever played, the session, I've told this story before, was a TV movie that Frank Sinatra starred in that Jerry Goldsmith did called Contract on Cherry Street. Mm-hmm. So it must have been like 1978 or 9. And I walk in, Robert, and there's 9 trombones and 5 clarinets and strings and piano and, you know, 9 trombones. Now, remember, I'm completely trained. By the time Tom and I are 18 years old, because of the infrastructure of young musicians, especially if you're a string player, you play in all these youth orchestras, but also what are called community orchestras. And community orchestras in a big city are, say an orchestra is like 80 or 90 people, right? So maybe 50 of them are amateurs, but they can play enough to where you can hear it. And then the union will give money to these orchestras so they can hire 30 professionals, which will be like studio players, that come in, do a dress rehearsal in the concert. So the concert and dress rehearsal sound pretty you know, pretty damn good. So by the time Tom and I are 17 or 18, we played all the Beethoven symphonies, all the Tchaikovsky symphonies, like we played hundreds of what is called the canon.
Yeah, the repertoire
of orchestra. So we're all completely trained in orchestra playing by the time we even enter college. This is just, it's not just us. It's this whole group of musicians that you know, cause you're on this track and it's like being on a soccer track or being on whatever it is. You're on this thing. So when I go in And I see this firsthand. It's like, wow, this is like, what's he going to do with nine trombones? I can't even think of a canon orchestral piece that has nine trombones. I can think of a couple that have like nine trumpets, maybe a Wagner opera. It's some has nine, you know. So he does this amazing stuff with it. So I started to get like interested in, wow, you can sort of do anything.
Beautiful.
In a film because you don't, if they're one-offs in a way, you're not, you it's not going to, your living isn't going to be made by a bunch of different orchestras or organizations playing this piece. You're writing this piece for this thing. This, he's using all this jazzy, like triadic chords, and he's got Dick Nash on the top doing, you know, and he's using it for jazz and then noir. And then, you know, it was, so I had about 10 years of, like Goldsmith, John Williams were the top, but also like Pat Williams and Marty, what the guy at CBS, I'm forgetting a lot of that. And even like Dominic Frontier, I don't know if you remember him, Robert, at all. These guys were a lot of television and a lot of it was horrible. Don't get me wrong. Like 80% of it is terrible, but 20% of it is, and of course you have to be a really good sight reader. But by the time Tom and I, you know, by the time we're 18, we can read anything.
Fly shit, as and they say.
It's like sight reading is a portion of just being really good at sight reading, understanding rhythmic patterns that you've seen over. It's the rhythm part that's the hardest thing in sight reading. But also knowing how to fake in a way and not get lost. So like you kind of. Some things you might not get the first time you play through it. That's why when, you know, Robert, when we read down a cue, it gets better the second and third time because you have a second time. But the first time, generally not anyone is so lost that you have to stop, right? Generally, the cue goes from the beginning to the end. And if this part is, you know, screwy, no one is saying stop. You know, we have to stop and start over again. It doesn't. Professionally, it doesn't work that way, you know. So you learn all this. I learned all this stuff before I got. So I was able to listen a lot. I wasn't so uncomfortable with the like the first cue in E.T. was that flying cue where the violins are way up and it's going dum 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 one two three one two one two three dum 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 dum. It's like a really difficult cue to play, but it's kind of like Stravinsky-ish and stuff. So, yeah, you might have a little difficulty.
Are you getting on it?
Around
are
a
you
little
playing?
Bit, but you're never lost. Yeah, no, I'm sitting in the first violins, probably on the last stand. I'm mostly in the last stand. You know, it's a
wow.
Would you John know, Williams it is what it nod is.
Oh,
to
yeah.
you and say, "Hey, welcome, ladies and gentlemen, in our audience tonight"?
No, no, oh no, 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 no. No, nothing. No, you just there were enough pissed off people. Freelancing, as you know, freelancing is a weird. There's no audition process. It's a you know, for an orchestra you have to audition. This is just a weird thing. It's fine once you sit down and play and you're
word
you,
of
you
mouth.
Know you have stand part. Well, you also have stand partners when you play a string instrument, so they can hear you play. It if you can't cut it, you're not gonna. You're not allowed anyway. And most film music isn't that hard to play. Just once in a while, it's you know it's hard.
There must have been a migration from you being this fiddle player to what was the moment? Because I never knew any of this, David. As long as we've known each other, I didn't know this, and I also am really deeply respectful of what you brought to film composing, which a lot of film composers don't know. You had 10 years, you said, of playing on those dates, but prior to that you also played in orchestras and you understood what orchestras did and you knew the canon. So many film composers, how many people say, wow man, you know, well, I made two records as a rock guitar player, what do you think about me doing film music? And I'm sort of stumped. And they also get hired and they kind of wing it.
No.
But I don't know the story of what was the event that migrated you.
It wasn't an event.
Did somebody call and say, write a film score for me?
I had a guy who was a friend who was a composer, and I started working. initially with a partner, which broke up very fast, like those things tend to do. But I did a couple of, like, remember they used to be, I like, industrial films and little, like, I did a Mondale, when Mondale was right. running, you know, we did a little thing. And I did a demo that was like, you know, an analog demo. It was not, it was like with, you know, all my friends, you know, we wrote a piece, about a 10-minute orchestra piece. And then we all, you know, I forget, probably everybody did it for free or whatever. Yeah. And then my Chris and I, my wife and I, who's also a violinist, you know, we probably overdubbed the violin part 15 times. And, you know, we did that sort of thing. It was a gradual thing for me. I was not, again, I had no experience composing, except when you're trained in a discipline called counterpoint, where and ear training, you have to take dictation and write down what you hear. But counterpoint, you have to write a canon, an invention, or like the exposition of a fugue or whatever. They're things that you have to learn how to do to pass out of the course. So it's not like I couldn't. It anybody trained in music that has the cojones to do it can write music. You can write music down. It's just, is it any good? You know? So it took me from about 81 to about 86 to really figure that this was a viable thing for me to do. So I sort of on and off worked less and less after I got married in 82. Maybe I did the Academy Award like 7 or 8 years in a row. One time I did the Academy Awards.
You mean as musical director?
And, just playing.
Oh, just playing. Okay.
But yeah, it was the best job there was. For a week of work, it was like $8,000. Nice. It was like a gold mine. But 1 year, you wear headphones, obviously. And 1 year they had the entire studio feed accidentally in our headphones. So you could hear the director call out cues, and you have never in your life heard anything so profane. I mean, talk about Lionel, Robert. This was like Lionel on steroids. And then 1 year Lionel did
oh,
it,
no.
And it was the first year off site. It was at Ocean Way, right. Remember? Well, it's still there. And we were all at Ocean Way, but they had never done a remote
right
before. And it was hairy. And Joanne was right next to Lionel because they never knew what was going to happen. And it wasn't all worked out yet doing remotes and stuff. And it was
right. They call out the movie and Joanne has to find the charts right away. Somebody
it's like two pages and they have like three bars of each movie. You can hear it. It's not, that isn't the worst part of it. The part of it is like when you play what, obviously, you know, when they announce a winner, you're going to play, but the rest of it, you know, you're just sitting there waiting and something weird. You know what I mean?
So, love it.
Anyway, that's just an aside.
I never thought about that.
But
part of it.
That thing about the directors in television, they are insane, those people in live television. I mean, that must be the most pressure there is.
Can you imagine their blood pressure level by the end of the night?
But they're using this incredibly, I don't know how to say it, but profane humor to get through it. They are making all kinds of comments that never in a million years would they want anyone to hear.
We're not regulated by the FCC, David. So if you want,
I'm not going to say.
Well, what's interesting is that you're.
It was fantastic.
In some ways, what I really love about all of this, and you also have just reminded me how and where we met, which was not at Fox. It was prior to.
That's right. I was playing fiddle.
And also,
you
arranged
Bruce Willis.
You arranged for a Bruce Willis record
on the
that
boardwalk.
I was producing. You
Well, I arranged some string.
And
parts,
I just
you know,
thought, wait a minute, here's a human being that can do things I couldn't do. I was very musical, but I couldn't write a string chart for a pop record. And you did this beautiful job. All hail John.
What year? Do you remember what year that
I can tell you
been?
It was 86, and John Vigran was my engineer.
That's right. That was when I'd started working. That's right, because I knew Vigran because he did some. He'd worked with Tom a lot, my brother Thomas, and he had done a couple of films for me too.
And you wrote a chart for Under the Boardwalk, which then went number one in England. It was a beautiful string part. But what's interesting to me hearing all of this, and also for our listeners to hear how much work and hours, you know, that 10,000 hours David brings to his job. What's curious is that in some ways, all of it adds up to you coming around to a new portion of your work, which is conducting live film music, which I've seen you do. And after I don't know how many movies you've done, you're now, I'd like to know if that was, if that's a joyful experience to be on the stage at the Hollywood Bowl or wherever these concerts are conducting, and also how it ties to West Side Story, because I saw you perform West Side Story. How did the live film music start to become such a major part of what you did?
Yeah. I don't want to go into too long a story, but were you at Fox at 80? When did you go to Fox?
94.
Okay, so in 1988, 89, around that time, I was doing the Composer's Lab at Sundance. Mm-hmm. You must have gone to that at some point in your career. Yeah. And we started a film music preservation program. Because the guy, Tom Wilhite, who ran it, who was my friend from Disney, and his partner, they were big film music fans. Hmm. And we started doing these clip shows. They weren't full movies, but we would do, like, the main title of Spartacus. And then Mancini would come and do the beginning of what's that movie? The Orson Welles movie, you know, where he's the
Third Man or...
No. It's I always forget this. It's that big long shot at the beginning where there's a bomb in the car and it blows up at the end of the bomb at the bomb. Anyway, we got all these, you know, Delarue came and Marvin Hamlisch. So we would do like a big show where they'd all do their own music, but with a film clip. But it was on it. But it was on a projector. Which I remember when you guys did the Fox show at the Bowl with Jerry. I mean, the Jerry show. It wasn't Jerry. It was with Macheri. That was on film, right? When you guys did that? Right. And so if you stopped in the middle with the film, you had to take the film off, hand crank it back. I mean, there was no rehearsing. And I remember you guys went way over time because... of the technical logistics. Now it's like, now when I do this, I have an iPad. I can go absolutely anywhere that I want in the film and say, bar, blah, 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 let's go. I have complete control of the rehearsal process.
And clicks so, also come up?
Clicks, streamers, anything you want. It's all clicked because it's the only way to... do the streamers. You can use them or not use them. So you sometimes use them, you sometimes don't use them. You know, it's whatever you need. And it depends on the conductor. Some conductors don't want to use it. For me, I'm interested in it being in sync. So like I did Singing in the Rain. And it's this really fast dancing. And it's been done for years without clicks. But I insisted on there's just no way to do that perfectly without doing it with a click track. And so we did it at the Bowl and it sounded great. You know, the guys in LA really know how to play that stuff. But yeah, that it little by little that's become more and more. That guy Macheri that did the Bowl from early on for about 20 years, he was really into this. So a lot of this development was because of him. Simply because he was here in LA. At the Bowl with a job, and they had some money. The LA Phils always had money because of the Hollywood Bowl. And they developed this into this really good thing. I took over his job, not his job, but I took over the movie night, I think in 2007. Hmm. So 7, 8, 9, 10, and 11, we did. They were all clip shows, meaning it was a something from this film, something from this film. But in 2011, we did West Side Story as a lot, as a full film. Now, there have been people that have been doing full films, you know, Psycho and but this was, I think, a turning point, because West Side Story was what's called, it was, they had one music stem, which had the orchestra, the vocals, and, you know, on it. And we didn't, we wanted the vocals from the film, but we didn't want the orchestra. Mm. So there was no way to do it until this, these companies figured out, using a computer process, how to get rid of the orchestra. So finally, when they do that, so now it means you can do any film now, even a mono film, because a mono film, like, say, like Casablanca, everything's on one stem, right, the dialogue and everything. So the only way to do that, they used to do this thing called dip and dive, and they would just, you know, when there was no dialogue, they just turn the sound down and up. But now you can, you know, you can do all this. But as I said, in my 20s, I was really into conducting. And I spent 9 to 10 hours a week studying with this one guy who nobody friggin' knew who he was. But he was a genius, as far as I was concerned. And I learned all this stuff that is very, very, very difficult to learn, in my opinion. I was interested in an orchestra following my beat. So mostly when you see people conducting, you'll see the orchestra behind
the beat. Never understood that.
It's
I'm not
because,
here.
Because yeah, it's okay. it's because of the nature of 100 people culturally in their little club having to play together. So you just minutely wait because you don't really trust the beat enough. So you wait for everybody to play. So I would have preferred it be like a band where the drummer or the kick drummer is it. That's the master tempo. So I was obsessed with this. So the only conductor I saw that was doing this was Toscanini, which a lot of people would look at and say, he's not doing anything. He's just beating time. But I could see, because I'm experience with it, how they are playing on his beat. It's almost like as if he went 1, 2, 3, 4 and stopped moving, that the orchestra would stop. Hmm. Now, you know, Robert, that a lot of time the conductor stops, the orchestra goes on playing, yes, for 3 bars because they're not watching. Now, this is degrees and nuanced and everything. But I finally, like I said, in my 28, 29, I sort of gave up on conducting and I thought, okay, I'm going to write film music, and all my energy went into there. But now I start conducting in 2007, and I'm doing okay. It's, you know, whatever, you know. But when I start, like, doing it, like, 2012, like, 10 or 11 times a year. Right.
With a live audience.
It's not the audience. It's the orchestras. Mm. So I'm going to these great orchestras. I'm going to Boston and Philadelphia and Cleveland and, like, you know, and in England and, you know, these are like the best orchestras in the world. And then all this training I had started to kick in for me again. So, things that I had not even thought about since I was in my 20s, I started to think about again. It's too nuance to go into detail, but and again, it's not something that you can do perfectly. So I always feel like the metaphor for a conductor is like flying. I've never flown a plane, but my understanding is when you're flying a plane, you're always a little bit off course. You drift off, you get back. You drift off, you get back. You drift off, you get back. And then as you come in for a landing, you got to be right perfect. You can't land screwed up, right? So now when you're doing films, you've got these streamers, right? So you might have like 30 bars that don't, it doesn't matter but you got to be at the streamer at bar 30, right? So we have these things that are called flutters or punches. So you put them on whatever bars it's in your score. And they're like navigations. You can see, yeah, I'm a little slow. I'm a little fast. I'm, you know, and conducting is like you're always trying to get back. So the other metaphor would be, Robert, like in a band, it's the feel of it. How is the groove? There is so much groove in orchestra music that no one ever talks about when you're conducting. If you, like, say, if it's a Mozart symphony or a Beethoven symphony, it's the way the pulse is designed. If you can get the orchestra into that groove, everything falls into place. It all blends. It feels like people start, like, wanting to move in their seats. So much orchestra music is rhythmic in nature, like this, you know? So this is what I was interested in. This is what I learned a method of doing. However imperfect I am in doing it, I have had moments where it has just been like a dream. Mm. Like, this is what it, this is for me. This is not for everybody. This is what it feels like when everything lines up, the groove is right. You know, and in canon music, the pulse is really important. In film music, it's like 95% of it is orchestra groove. Whatever it is, if it's comedy, noir, it you know, now you can you do groove a lot with band instruments and stuff. But still, a lot of, when you have an orchestra, even playing with a band groove, like a pulsing bass line, if anyone in the orchestra is moving, and they're not moving in a way that's appropriate with the bass line, it just feels bad. It's like the drummer dragging, or, you know, in a band, whoever is dragging, if the bass player is dragging, everyone has to go with them. You can't not be together. You have to be together. But it screws up everything. And when it gets right, it just, it's like the easiest thing.
You're in the zone.
You relax. You're in the zone. You're relaxed. You're not thinking about it. You've rehearsed it, and it just goes. Yeah. So my best experience with that, and then I'll shut up about it, is in 2017, I did all four Star Wars movies that are being done live now, which is the first three and the last one, in a month with the New York Philharmonic, who I love, right?
Wow.
So I had about 30 services in a month. So the more that I did this, the more they got used to me, the better this got. So I could rehearse, like, the Return of the Jedi, I think, has 120 minutes of music. So we have, like, two rehearsals. So it's about 5 hours of rehearsal for 2 hours of music. You can't rehearse that. So this is the other thing with conducting, is conducting is a nonverbal, quote unquote, art form. Mm-hmm. You can't stop in a performance and say, hey, that's not, you know, that's loud. It's a third person thing conducting. You're not playing anything. You're moving your body around. Right. So it's a very nuanced, weird thing. But the more I did it, to answer this question in a long way, that is the favorite thing about it is that.
Nice.
I get very nervous. I love the audience, because once it gets going, I find applause mildly fascist, if that makes sense.
I'll go
it's
with
like,
that.
There's something weird about, though, you know, it's nice to be applauded, but it's not, it's a weird, what I like is the communal, everyone there stuffed, you know, in the least COVID way, right. Stuffed together, watching this movie that they're so happy to be able to watch with other people and be. I do love that. I get horribly nervous before I step out on stage. Once I'm on stage, I'm fine. So if it wasn't for the traveling and the hanging around, it would be a lot easier for me. But that's sort of my take on
that. I can feel the passion you have for this for conducting Ditto. So much through your storytelling of your experiences doing that. It's very clear that this is and was your favorite thing to start. And it's so cool that you were able to finally get back into doing what you originally wanted to. Aside from the fact that you scored a bunch of great movies and your scores are fantastic.
Well, yeah.
Really quick, we're going to take a break. And then when we come back, we're going to ask you, there's so much to talk about. And David, I could seriously listen to a 7-hour episode of David telling these stories. But stick around, more with David Newman when we return.
Hey, it's Matt Schrader here. If you like Score the Podcast, you're going to want to check out More Score, our new Patreon show for Score superfans. What's Patreon? Well, it's a website and an app that lets fans crowdfund the type of extra content you want. And now, More Score has it all on video. You can listen or watch right on the Patreon app. More Score already has the life stories of people you know, like Kenny and Robert from Score the Podcast, as well as bonus features, hangouts, and yes, original interviews, like Carlos Rafael Rivera from The Queen's Gambit on Netflix. Did you know he had to throw out his score and start fresh? More Score gives you insight into the film score world, and it's a beautiful addition to those of you who just can't wait for another episode of Score the Podcast. Best of all, More Score is year-round, no more off-season. Go to patreon.com/morescore or download the Patreon app and search More Score.
Hi, this is Ludvig Göransson. You're listening to Score the Podcast, and now let's go back to the show.
Welcome back to Score the Podcast, presented by Spitfire Audio. We're here with David Newman, learning so much about conducting, about your history, about your family's history. Robert asked you a little bit about West Side Story, and I know that it's probably under lock and key, so we can't get into too many details about the film, but I did want to ask you about working with Spielberg. I mean, you were on recording sessions with E.T., and, you know, you've been in the presence of Steven and worked with him in different ways, but now you're working side by side with him as the composer, arranger of this new film. What was that like for you to be in that role?
Let me, to be clear, I didn't do any I did a little bit of arranging. Quite frankly, in West Side Story, 95% of the music are songs and dances. There's a little bit of interstitial music, but it's all based on the show. Well, stuff like it's more towards the end of the movie, after Bernardo and Riff are killed. There are a few little things of something. There's another song that does have an arrangement, but mainly this was my role in West Side Story. I did a lot of the. Actually, I'm probably not supposed to say that. I did not conduct this. Dudamel conducted. Correct. Gustavo. Yep.
That's known.
I supervised it. I got on this to back up 2011. Remember, I said
that's what I was wondering about as we mentioned.
So
how did that tie in the fact that you?
Okay, it did because the Bernstein office. It's the LBO, the Leonard Bernstein office. They're very proactive with Leonard Bernstein's music in the classical world, and they are the ones that produced or helped produce this movie, West Side Story. We also did On the Waterfront as well, which is another story. But they were very much involved in the movie. They it's no secret that they hated the 1961 version, the Robert Wise version.
I never knew.
West Side Story. Oh, they detested it. They would have liked West Side Story. That's, you know, Bernstein, Sondheim, Arthur Lawrence, and Jerome Robbins. Though Jerome Robbins was a co-director, so I guess he couldn't really say that. But I think those guys would have preferred that it was a black and white, sweaty mono movie in a way. I mean, not mono because of the voice, but you know what I mean? A claustrophobic, black and white, sweaty, like it is on
the waterfront originally.
Like On the Waterfront. Of course, it starts off like The Sound of Music, right? is going to start off a couple of years later, you know, with that big panning shot into the thing. You know, most of our thoughts about West Side Story from the movie, obviously, not from most more people have seen the movie. Anyway, be that as it may, we did the movie. It was very popular, and I got friendly with the office because I had to work so closely with them, and then I worked with them on the Waterfront and everything. So when the movie came, John was supposed to do it, though there really was nothing to do in the movie but kind of oversee it and make sure it didn't go off the mm-hmm. rails, which is sort of my job. So John asked me if I would sort of take over for what he was quote unquote going to do, whether that was real or not. And so that's what I ended up doing. So I ended up sort of overseeing the music part. I did a little arranging, I did a little orchestrating, but it was kind of a big group effort. Mm. There was a vocal person, there was a music supervisor, there was me, there was Spielberg. It was a little chaotic at times, but it turned out great, I can say. Mm. It is a wonderful take on West Side Story. It's very young. I don't know. I don't know if you've seen the trailer.
Yeah, at the Oscars.
They're very young. Mm. And I think that's it. It's more akin to the Romeo and Juliet, a modern sort of Romeo and Juliet, which is really the way it was designed in the first place. The singing ended up being very good. Some really, really good stuff, but it's really characterful and it's lovely. It's a lovely movie. It was very difficult and we got, you know, cock blocked, you know, by COVID. We weren't quite done yet. Right. Like we were 3 days from, we were going to go to New York in March. And, I knew we weren't, Robert. It was so nuts. We were at Fox talking, and they're all planning. We're going to go to New York, and we all knew. We're not, you know. So we were supposed to be in March 23rd, 2020, in New York recording. So it shut down.
A week before.
5 days. Yeah. And if we had gone, we would have just gotten stuck in New York. The whole thing shut down. We ended up then going back and recording the prologue, which we hadn't done yet. That's what was left out. And other little things, which we did at Fox and finished up. And then they dubbed the movie, which they were able to do because it's not a million people. Yeah. And we just finished doing the soundtrack, which I must say sounds amazing. And it wasn't easy to do. It's some of the most difficult music to sing. Talk about, Robert, you know, we're talking about groove and pocket and vocal quality and color, and that the music in West Side Story, it's like it straddles opera and vaudeville, and it is extremely difficult
and mambo
thing to it, everything Latin, all kinds of that Latin music that was so popular in the late 50s in New York, so. It was a very tricky thing to do, but it turned out I think great. I don't know how it's going to be.
I'm sure it's going to be huge. And you just have reminded me.
I'm going to indulge
in asking a very high tech musical question about West Side Story that I realized here is someone who can enlighten me. I've always been curious about the use of the tritone in West Side Story and how important it is. It's both for tension with the Jets, and it's for romance with Maria. Yeah.
It's all.
But then I started to realize it's also in On the Waterfront, how it's almost like Bernstein rehearses using that a little earlier than West Side Story. But what has always been clear to me is that they're coming out of the bebop era where Charlie Parker is using the tritone.
It's a blues
salt
thing.
Peanuts.
It's
salt peanuts.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
Did you hear my question? Here's my question. It's simply this: Did you realize that On the Waterfront and West Side Story had some confluence, regardless of the bebop influence, by the same composer using this interval that was kind of signature of that era.
Yeah, the sharp four, which they generally move down to the fourth or the flat third. They're kind of blues, New York, Broadway thing. Also, they call it a shofar. Am I pronouncing that right? The Jewish call to worship is an one of the intervals in that is a that's I think in a way what Bernstein was
never
thinking.
Thought that.
I didn't either, but that's what they call it in the.
I always thought of it also as a flat five, not a sharp four.
Yeah, yeah.
But I just.
Or a sharp 11. It's an interval.
The devil's interval.
It's an interval he liked. It's the middle of the 12 notes of the scale. It's an interval that was shunned in medieval and Renaissance and the classical era and a little bit less in Romanticism and then started to be used a lot, but definitely in Tin Pan Alley and vaudeville and blues. And, you know, Gershwin uses it all the time in the flat third, you know.
Yeah.
Let's see, Street Scene. Da, 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 da. They use the flat third.
That's
the
so Gershwin-esque, sort of the same thing. Right?
Written before the Street Scene's written before Porgy and Bess, actually. But I don't know, all that stuff is in the air in New York in the 30s, you know. Even Copeland wrote for any of your viewers. I think it's his piano concerto 1927. It's the only one he wrote is a complete jazzy. It's fantastic. You guys should all
go out
and check that out. The Copeland piano.
It's my
concerto. I think it's 1927.
My next favorite.
It's great.
David, can you tell us about being in the scoring stage with Spielberg? Is he pretty vocal in there? Does he sit back? Like what's the vibe like with Spielberg?
He films. He likes to film stuff. So a lot of his views of stuff is behind a camera, even when we're doing stuff. But and he knows when to talk and he knows when to not talk. He knows when to let things get worked out and he knows when to, you know, and let's face it, Spielberg movies are the best dub movies there are. You know, we talk about dubbing, Robert, where the final mix, the way Spielberg uses music in his film, it's
unparalleled.
It's just brilliant. It's in my opinion, he allows the music.
He also
to
has
do
a pretty good composer.
Designed.
So it's valuable.
But it's also it's a sensibility.
When you say he's filming, like he's got his camera out on the stage, just filming constantly.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I think he likes to look at. This is my opinion. He doesn't say this to me, but a lot of it he's filming.
I wonder if it's for his own personal diaries.
No,
it is, or EPK.
Or you know, for both. I think
I can't wait for the movie. I literally can't wait. I'm so excited. I'm so excited to hear it. And I don't know if I'll hear it in a big theater and hear how it's mixed.
It's a big December 26th. It's a big, huge widescreen movie. It is gorgeous looking. It's gorgeous. And it doesn't look like I'm not a great visual person, but it's not like what you would think it would look like. It's pretty period. Anyway, you probably
can't
saw
wait.
The trailer.
I do know. It's funny when you said the Romeo and Juliet. Of course, we know that, but I've always loved the story, whether it's true or not, or is mythic, that Jerome, Arthur Lawrence, Stephen Sondheim, and Leonard were all at the Beverly Hills Hotel around the pool. Talking about Romeo and Juliet, and could they do something about it? And someone in that mentioned the west side of Manhattan and the gang fights between recent Puerto Rican immigrants and the whites who felt they wanted the turf. And there was this moment of, hey, wait a minute. You know, we could put Romeo and Juliet in the middle of that. Is that true?
They, well, Originally, it was called East Side Story, and it was a Jewish gang versus, I think, an Irish gang. And it didn't really resonate. And I think, I don't know the story. I'm sure it's easy to Google the story out there. But it ended up, like you said, it ended up being more of an ethnic story I know it was originally called East Side Story.
Do you think that this of all the experiences that you've described for us in this wonderful conversation, do you feel that the next item, unless you know it, on your agenda veers more towards of your various skill sets, conducting, composing, arranging, performing? Do you feel that film composing is going to be just part of the mix? What's next for David Newman?
I try not to plan. I'd like to do more film composing. I'm working, so I have a show, but
great.
The conducting's been off for the year, but I'm supposed to do Princess Bride at the Hollywood Bowl at the end of July.
I'll be there. And then, I can't wait.
If we do it, and then I have several other things booked. A couple of Christmas Home Alone.
Nice, John Williams.
That's favorite. One of the ones I premiered that in. I think 2012 in Cleveland, in a horrible.
That sounds like a bad movie, so. Right there. But
I want to ask you, but COVID aside, where do you see the future of these film music concerts? Because in the 2000s, you were like starting something. It's all over the world now, and they're doing them and different philharmonics. This is putting a lot of people to work doing these sorts of things. And it's letting young people experience orchestras in conjunction with their favorite films. But as somebody who does this and was kind of leading the charge early on, where do you think these live concerts are headed? Is this something that's going to be as prominent as regular concerts in the future, do you think?
I really don't know how to answer that. I can't believe that it's taken off the way that it has, though I shouldn't be surprised. The way this stuff works, you have to convince the musicians of these orchestras that there's a hierarchy of orchestras around the world. Not to get into details, but just imagine, they're the A list, the B list, the C list, right? You have to convince the musicians, but you also have to convince the artistic staff, the CEO, the head of artistic administration. There's also an administrative hierarchy that you have to convince. And I think to a certain extent, we've been able to convince the musicians of the efficacy. In other words, film music historically has been so denigrated, but it's been denigrated by people that don't even know what they're talking about. They haven't listened to it. They haven't studied it. And a lot of that isn't their fault. It's so difficult to get your hands on the material because it's not owned by a publishing company. It's owned by a film studio. What do they care about? They don't know where it is. They don't even know what the hell the music prep department half the time is doing, So there's that. So I get that. But now, let me give you an example. So let's say I'm with the New York Philharmonic, right? And we're doing E.T. And, they know the tune from E.T. They've played it with John a million times, the flying theme and all that stuff, right? But now we're playing the whole film, right? So we start off, right? We go, so there's a particular cue where the mother is reading to Drew Barrymore character, Peter Pan, right? And the E.T. and Elliot, the little kid, they're in a closet hiding from the mom. They're always hiding from the adults. The kids don't ever want the adults to see the E.T. because who knows what the adults are going to do. So they're watching her read to Tinkerbell, right? And the harp is doing this beautiful harp thing, which you may remember. It goes da-dee, da-da-da-dum. And then it trills like brrr, which is this thing called bisbigliando on the harp. And it occurs that's the fluttering of Tinkerbell's wings. That's the purr of the wings. And they start talking about clapping. Now that you've heard this theme before, once with Elliot and the ET, but now you're hearing it, the ET and Elliot watching the mother the kid, right? And there's another theme that you hear in the beginning of the movie, which I would call like a kind of a little bit of a menacing theme that's about the adults that goes dun da 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 da, which is at the beginning of the movie, right? So back to this scene. They're doing this, clapping for Tinkerbell, and the camera starts moving out, right? And this little bass note comes in, and you see a van, and you hear voices in the van, and you hear adults talking in the van. And this one flute plays that motive really low in its register. It goes dum da dum bum while the harp is still going. Now that is just brilliant. Now you're never going to know what that is until it had to be set up from the beginning, and you have, you know, and so okay, you're doing three or four performances, right? It might not like kick in for a few, right? But they start to hear what's going on. They can hear the dialogue. They can't really see the film, but they all know the film. And this starts, oh, that's what film composing is. It's not, film composing isn't writing concert music. It's film composing. It's its own thing. It deserves to be studied, written about. It deserves in like Robert, you said, in depth, not just the periphery of, this is a nice tune in this. What is going on with this? How is he doing this? You know, and I'll give you one more example from E.T. We get the video for these to practice, the conductors, with everything separated. So you can mute the music. So you practice without the music on. So you make sure, you know, am I going too fast here? Am I going too fast? Right? Okay. So turn off the music at the beginning of E.T. and you listen to the effects to. And there's like a wolf howling, and and there are these little creatures sneaking around, and it seems kind of weird, you know. It's like, what's going on? You know, it's eerie, right? Then you put the music in, and it's like religious. It's like they're botanists. They're not there to disturb anything. They're the most benevolent creatures there are. It's very hard to tell in film music what's going on if you can't take away the music. This is another problem studying film music. You have to be able to take it away, look at it, you know, yeah, you could mute it, but you can't hear what the composer's hearing or what, you know, and yeah, the filmmaker, when there's no music, will fill it up more, will adjust, but there's a reason there's music in movies. And this is what's great about it, is as these orchestras hear it over and over, it sells tickets for sure. This is why the administrators do it, right? The musicians, what are they? They're not, that's not their focus, really. Their focus is to give the best performance that they can. But you have to convince both of them that this is worthwhile. So my feeling is, if they get to the point where instead of doing Star Wars or Jurassic Park or, you know, these big, huge, popular movies, that they could do a movie like we did On the Waterfront or Streetcar Named Desire or a myriad of movies that have great scores but are not blockbuster movies, where you actually might have to do a little bit of marketing and bring your audience along with you over a long period of time, which is the way that these organizations work. If you have a project, you don't expect it to just immediately be this big hit. You bring it slowly along, kind of what Solonen did with the LA Phil with all their new music concerts. Little by little, over 20 years, he brought it from 200 or 300 people at a concert to Disney Hall, where it's 1,500 people at these wacky new music concerts that are, no one knows, has ever heard any of the music. It's all nuts and insane. And little by little, they develop. I hope they do this. And I would love it if they would do original content or, you know, short form content or, you know, but they have to be convinced that this is reasonable to do.
Yeah. Well, that's
sort of a long answer for me.
You also have to introduce the audience to what it is, because if you're not using those big properties and those big films that are familiar, then the excitement isn't really there. But then once you get them drawn in, then it's like, oh, well, what movie's playing now? It doesn't matter what it is.
I think you also need David Newman to shine a light, literally shine a light on the intricacy and brilliance. I mean, everybody who's listening to this, and certainly the people here that are doing this conversation with you, all love and appreciate and learn from exactly what you're talking about, which is film composers are this unique little tribe of artists and thinkers and conceptualists that are just, I have so much appreciation for the art of film composing, but also to have you guide us today is really a treat. It's a real gift. And even now, I just want to go back and watch E.T., and I want to see that scene, and I want to think about the music in a way, because we all know, and it's a whole other podcast, the visual image and the narrative so overwhelm the music that you're suddenly going, wow, what's going to happen right now to Drew Barrymore, and what's going to happen to Elliot, and oh no, is this, you know, what's happening in the story, and the music's just, I always felt...
Well, the music seems inevitable, and that story you were telling about Zanuck being blown away, it's like the idea that that didn't exist at one point, and then it was introduced, and it's like, well, of course this is how it's supposed to be. It's so obvious now that a film without music is not, it's not what it's supposed to be.
Like a day without sunshine.
Yeah, it really is.
It's I've been really fascinated recently with the 30s, and obviously because that's the era of my father when he came, and how they developed. You should watch some 30s movie, or 31, 32, 33. It's just wacky. The use of music, you can see them struggling.
I love that.
With how
is there one particular one you want to leave us with as a tip?
There's a movie that my father did called Rain. It's with what's her face, the famous actress, Mommy Dearest, Joan Crawford. Mm. It's an early Joan Crawford film, and the music is just basically source music from her. They're stuck on an island, and she's kind of a prostitute, and then there's a preacher that's obsessed with her, and it's a very noirish movie, but it's just so weird the way the music is used. But there are other ones like Street Scene, where it's just like an overture, no music for an hour, and then some music, and then no music for an hour, and then a little bit of music. But 1939 is Wizard of Oz and Gone with the Wind, and you know, and I've been reading, I just read the Steve Smith Bernard Herrmann book. And I'm in the middle of the Max Steiner book, which just came out. And there's a lot of information about how this all developed. Steiner was the pioneer, probably. Him and my father, but Steiner really a little bit before my father.
King Kong.
You can see how this all, yeah. But also he did a 31 movie, I forget the name of it, where it's all through composed. But you can see them struggling. A couple movies, they get to write original music, and then it's a bunch of stuff. You know, they have to music direct and do.
Well, so we are getting schooled.
I know. I was just going to say, we need to do a round two of this, David, and hopefully next time in person.
Really, David, the source of unbelievable information. We are at the school of Professor David Newman today, and I think that we have all just benefited so hugely. It really, and I was just, I was planning to talk about Alvin and the Chipmunks, the Squeakquel.
Oh, yes.
Ice Age, we did so many together, but this was, to me, just incredible deep background on the art of film music, which is such a gift.
David, thank you so much for joining us. A reminder to our listeners, you can follow us. There's a number of ways. Twitter @ScoreThePodcast, Instagram @ScoreMovie, Facebook @ScoreAFilmMusicDocumentary. Don't forget to subscribe on Patreon to our new show, More Score. It's year-round, plenty of interviews and all the extra bonus stuff that you don't get here on the show. Thanks again to our sponsor, Spitfire Audio. Stick around after the show today. We're going to play you a clip of demo queue of some of the different packages they offer as well. And we will be back in a couple of weeks with another episode. Robert, take it away.
I was just going to say, I'm going to have to sort of spend the next little while this morning just kind of floating on this conversation, David. It's just, there's so much history in what you've shared today, and it's a real pleasure to just reconnect with you.
Me too, Robert. I just want to say also, I'll never forget what you did for that stage.
Oh, well.
That's just, was such a mitzvah.
It was a lucky moment, and listen, it paid off because we recorded so many great scores there.
Thanks, Carol. Thank you, Kenny.
Hey, Score listeners, we're so grateful for the support of Spitfire Audio. They collaborate with people like Hans Zimmer and the Bernard Herrmann Estate to build sample libraries that elevate your music. You're about to hear a musical demo of what that sounds like.
Robert, that is so true. And as an exclusive to our Score listeners, that's you and viewers now, we have a deal for you. Spitfire is offering 25% off your first order of Spitfire products. Just use the promo code SCORE2021 in the cart. That lets them know we sent you, and it saves you a bunch of money. So use it while it lasts. It's exclusive to you, the Score the Podcast listeners. Just go to spitfireaudio.com and use the promo code SCORE2021 to save 25%. Now check this out. We're going to play you a cue right now from the Abbey Road 1 Orchestral Foundations package. Take a listen. Again, that promo code is SCORE2021. It won't last forever, so don't wait. Use it now to save 25% off your first order of Spitfire products. And I think in 2 weeks, we're coming back with another episode. What do you think about that, Robert?
I can't wait. And I think the only appropriate way to acknowledge the wonderfulness of this episode we just finished is to ask composer Carol to say bye.
Bye.
We're there.
I love the delay. There was some drama there. We needed to score that. We could have scored that with the Abbey Road One Orchestral Foundation.
It was emotional for me just to hear that. That pause. That pause really kind of like.
Bye.
All right. We'll see you in a couple weeks on Score the Podcast, or you can join more Score and get some listening going right now. There's tons waiting for you on more Score. Join now, and we'll see you.